Been a long day, and let's really get started right now. But I do want to thank the organizers for this opportunity to present some philosophical ideas to an expert audience here. And this is a pretentious title, Set Theoretic Truth. Okay, the talk will be informal, but I need to mention a few technicalities towards the end, in particular V equals ultimate L. And I had the impression, you know, Monroe was answering a question concerning Woodin, and he said something like, well, in all fairness to Woodin, that sounds like the community is already considering Woodin to be gone, far gone, you know? all right. So, but, well, this is just an antidote to the multiverse, that's all the rave right now. So let's start. I have a motto to this talk, and it's taken from Ian Hacking. He wrote a nice book. It's called Why Is There Philosophy of Mathematics at All? Right? And he says, philosophizing about mathematics is haunted by Platonism. And the pun here is, it works in English as well as in French, like ontologie sounds like ontologie, right? So, all right. This is the abstract, which I won't read to you because you have it already, and the contents is basically considering we have four parts, setting the stage, what kind of Platonism, and Frege, you know, I think he was confronted with a tetralemma. You know, he was a Platonist, of course, but there were these alternatives at this time. It's this empiricism and psychologism and formalism. He didn't like them at all, so he, of course, stayed with Platonism. but I will quickly go through these alternatives. And then there is a notion in part three, theoretical naturalism. You know, I had to find a name that would be something that I would propose, and some informal idea of mathematical truth in general, and finally set theoretic truth, where I will talk about you wouldn't. All right, so let me start with Pfefferman, and I read it to you. I am a convinced anti-Platonist in mathematics. Briefly, according to the Platonist philosophy, the objects of mathematics, such as numbers, sets, functions, spaces, are supposed to exist independently of human thoughts and constructions, and statements concerning these abstract entities are supposed to have a truth value independent of our ability to determine them. Though this accords with the mental practice of the working mathematician, I find the viewpoint philosophically preposterous, right? So that causes a problem because Saul Pfefferman is, of course, one of the leading logicians for the last 50 years. Now, I would like to distinguish between anti-Platonism and non-Platonism. And for that, I use the metaphor of the House of Mirrors effect. Both Platonism and anti-Platonism appear to be still under the same spell of medieval ontological thinking, as they merely reflect the opponent's position by negating it. So the picture anti-Platonists draw of Platonism is a straw man picture. The anti-Platonists cleave to the very same conceptual framework as the Platonist, and in attacking what Bill Tate calls superrealism, which involves a global, Tate calls it a model in the sky hovering over the sensible world in which all mathematical statements are eternally determined to be either true or false. Well, the proposed non-Platonist cure that I would support is sidestepping the false dichotomy superrealist Platonism versus superrealist anti-Platonism, but instead develop a conception of a theoretical naturalism in the philosophy of mathematics, and we'll come to that. Now here's a list of some pronouncements of Platonist superrealism, both supporting it and against it, the anti-Platonists. And I just mentioned these names, you know, G.H. Hardy, everybody knows him. And Brouwer is against, of course. Michael Dummett gives the philosophical underpinning of anti-Platonism. Stephen Simpson against Penelope Maddy started out as a Platonist and now went back to retreated to some kind of naturalism. Alain Conne, the field medalist, pro. Richard Thiessen, he's a Husserl scholar, deeply anti. Balaguer, he wrote a whole book about the thing, but basically on this kind of superrealist picture. And H. Garth Dales, he is a working mathematician, and I will explain later why I mention him at all. And Saul Pfefferman, of course, anti. Stuart Shapiro is a structuralist. Basically, he's a Platonist, I guess. And Marco Panza and Andrea Sereni, they wrote this book, Plato's Problem, and developed the whole machinery of philosophical discussion here. And so what is the nature of mathematical objects under this view of superrealism? There's this separate mathematical realm of abstract mathematical objects. These objects are non-physical outside of space and time. They are uncreated and immutable, not subject to generation and corruption. They are causally inert. They are independent of the human mind. And they are not invented, but discovered. It's the old kind of topos. And the nature of truth under this view is, of course, simply correspondence view. Very easy. You have this model in the sky, and the elements there are the satisfiers of mathematical statements. The problem is, of course, the epistemic axis problem as epitomized by Benasrov's gambit. Okay, Frege's tetralemma, real quick. Platonism again, empiricism and cognates, psychologism and formalism. And I won't read that to you, you know, Hardy's statement about, you know, somewhat self-important, the typical kind of self-important remarks he makes. Doesn't have anything to do with this mathematical genius, of course. Dummett, basically the same. Gödel, we don't have to read that. Everybody knows the Russell paper, right? I only want to point at the particular notion here where he says legitimate. So the first part is kind of ontological, but here legitimate. And that is, of course, more kind of view that we need it. Right, that's a different approach. And here Gödel on subjective versus objective, and again he talks about outside reality. But there's a caveat there. It's in conversation with Wang, you know, and I actually don't trust Wang that much. Anyhow, traditional empiricism. Frege, well known, his scathing comments on Mill's pebble arithmetic. In German it's called Pfefferkuchen arithmetic. Yeah? And then there are these varieties of naturalism. Philip Kitcher's naturalism, George Lakoff, and Rafael Nunes was mentioned before here. Where does mathematics come from? Quine, of course. And Matt is naturalism in mathematics, so they are really different kind of approaches. My common problem with these approaches, you know, I'm not talking about Quine, but Kitcher and Lakoff and Matt is the lack of theory. Okay, so I can appreciate, of course, that concept formation, you know, has to take into account the affordances, as the psychologists say, of the world around us, right? But then that's not all. So in this book, Lake of Nunez, they don't make the leap of faith, which is really doing theory. So, you know, there's this famous Heidegger notion of Seinsvergessenheit, and I would say, you know, forgetfulness of being, and I would say this is a kind of theory forgetfulness. Huh? Okay, so Quine, I only want to point at Bet Omega here, because he says, well, he would acknowledge some innumerable infinites, but only as they are used in science. But beyond Bet Omega, you know, that's mathematical recreation, right? Which I find amusing. And then again, later on, in a later paper, not well known, he comments on Pfefferman's system W, that's while vindicated. You know, it's a system of flexible finite types, but which he proved to be conservative over PA. And Pfefferman actually claimed of this system that you can do virtually all modern physics in. That was his claim. And Quine liked that and said this would be a momentous result. It would make a clean sweep of the innumerable infinites and unspecifiable sets. Now, Maddy's naturalism, just one sentence, if our philosophical account of mathematics comes into conflict with successful mathematical practice, it is the philosophy that must give. That sounds like an unconditional surrender. I won't go into it further because I have to press on here. I won't say much about Frege. Everybody knows Frege, that he thinks, of course, being true is quite different from being held as true. And then his famous rant against Husserl, where he says, reading this work, Husserl's Philosophie der Arithmetik, made me realize the extent of devastations wrought on logic by the incursion of psychology into the field, right? Husserl scholars actually say that's unfair to Husserl, but I won't go into that. Another interesting quote is Dedekind. You know, he talks about the free creations. And so that's in a letter to Heinrich Weber. It's about cardinal numbers, and he said, well, not just take these equivalence classes, but something new, which the mind creates. We are of divine lineage and doubtlessly possess creative power, not only in material things, railroads, telegraphs, but especially in, well, there is geistige Dinge, Chris, perhaps spiritual is not the right word, things, okay. And here I would give Dedekind the benefit of the doubt, you know, perhaps I come back to it. So I would not consider Dedekind, thinking in psychological terms. So for me, that could be viewed as an instance of theoretical naturalism. And Brouwer, I've always liked to read that to people because it's really extreme. Thus, for a human mind equipped with an unlimited memory, pure mathematics practiced in solitude and without using linguistic science would be exact, but the exactness would be lost in mathematical communication between human beings with an unlimited memory because they would still be thrown upon language as their means of understanding. But the intuitionist Martin Löf, you know, admitted recently that, quote, Brouwer's views on language were of a rather old-fashioned nature. They have been replaced now, in our camp here, by language as a means of communication. But communication is quite restricted. It's basically narrowed down to verificationism. For instance, Doug Parvitz he says that non-verifiable statements are meaningless. And a chief philosopher to defend that was Michael Dummett. So they were against, of course, the tatium non datur. And here's an interesting quote by Martin Löf for the satirist among you. He, at one point, he likens LEM to large cardinal axioms and definable determinate axioms as principles without proper content, but that are used to smooth out the theory, right? So he says, so the law of excluded middle has to be arranged together with large cardinal and determinacy axioms, rather than with the axioms of which we have a constructive or contentful understanding, meaning what has content, you know, must be constructive, right? So you can think about that. Now, formalisms, there's a lot of, typically, a proliferation of these formalisms, term formalism, game formalism, Frege's time, Hilbert's formalism, Wittgenstein's formalism, Carnap's syntacticism, so-called fictionalism, and the proof formalism, of course, of the working mathematician. Here's a quote from Wittgenstein. Mathematics, everything is algorithm. You know, even when we think it's about things, it's basically, you know, calculation. And fictionalism, just one word, didn't really want to pick on Hartree Field, but he did write, the fictionalist can say that the sense in which 2 + 2 + 4 is true is pretty much the same as the sense in which Oliver Twist lived in London is true. Now, if that strikes you as a little bit undercomplex, you're not alone. Okay, but interestingly, here's a book by Haskell Curry. He has a little book on formalist philosophy. And I looked into it, and he is against formalism, a game formalism. It's not a game. It consists of propositions, not formulas, but real propositions. What are real propositions? He even uses the German Sinn erfüllte Wahrheiten, which is, you know, literally truths that full of meaning or full of sense, right? And they determine the fundamental definitions. And he's against Carnap. He says Carnap leads to extreme nominalism, and he doesn't like that. And he's against Hilbert as well, because the formalism, which is, of course, a question whether Hilbert's formalism is formalism in the first place, he calls it Hilbertism. So mathematics, according to Curry, is the science of formal systems. They have to be used for real-world applications, right? And the important thing is for him, mathematics has to have applications, but otherwise no restrictions. And so he is, let me go through this, he's arguing, of course, classically. So he accepts the law of excluded middle. And here comes H. Garth Dales. Why him? In 1976, Dales proved the negation of Kaplansky's conjecture on Banach algebras. You know, Kaplansky is an analyst, all kinds of conjectures, and he is one of Banach algebras, using the continuum hypothesis. But Soloway and Woodin provided the model for, so that's a negation. But there's also, it's also consistent if you take out the continuum hypothesis, take Martin's axiom, and plus the NDH means non-discontinuous homomorphism. So Dales and Woodin later teamed up to write a book about this. It's The Introduction to Independence for Analysts. And interestingly, Dales came to defend formalism, so he's a hardcore mathematician, but Woodin, apparently, he's a realist, I guess. So, and Dales has some formalist criteria, which I won't read to you. It's the typical, you know, kind of normativity criteria, whatever you call them, simplicity, centrality, fecundity, depth, aesthetic value. That's what mathematicians typically say, and only stop at contradiction. So here is the non-Platonist stance. It sidesteps, as I said, the dichotomy of superrealist Platonism versus superrealist anti-Platonism. Consequently, there is no need to even begin to confront nominalism as the most obvious form of superrealist anti-Platonism. And so we don't have to deal philosophically, we don't have to deal with universals, you know, because abstract things, do they exist or not, or concepts, properties, do they exist? That's a discussion that has to be, you know, argued anyway, you know, that's not specific to mathematics. That's not to say that nominalistic theories are worthless, you know, it's kind of what I call resource-conscious reasoning. So with minimal tools, try to prove as much as possible. That's okay. And naturalizing mathematics, this is sort of the rough outline of what I mean by this here. First of all, deflate ontology. The problem about Platonism is, you know, that everybody is fixed like, here are the concrete objects and somewhere are the abstract objects, and they have basically similar properties. That's not the case. You don't need this kind of ontology. Primacy is given to the abstract concepts over the objects. So mathematical concepts are theory-bound, abstract, what I call cultural artifacts. So they are created, right? Say more about it in the discussion, perhaps. And the concepts and the rules of use, which are called axioms, open up abstract logical spaces, which are explored with the help of logical languages and their theories. And the terms of a given language work like tangible pegs for logical space around which definitions, axioms, hypotheses, and proofs structure a domain of investigation. And I support a principle of plenitude. Existence in the abstract realm is relatively cheap, but truth is not. Actually, I found a similar idea in Peter Kölner somewhere. Now, this is important, the objectivity of mathematics, because when you're a Frege-ian, then it's easy to see why mathematics is objective, because there is this model in the sky. Where does the objectivity of mathematics come from in this naturalized mathematics? That is due to the canon of precision in the formation of its concepts and the strictness of its proof techniques within the frame of public, and this is important, and collective processes of correction and validation, right? Okay, the conception of mathematical truth sort of derived from that. It's very informal, but I want to highlight the main points. It's highly theoretical. So for instance, Hilbert worried about, in his famous paper on the infinite, worried about whether or not there are infinities in nature. That's completely irrelevant to me. Continuous with science, that's important. And again, like Frege, he said, the application to the real world is important, rooted in abstractions from our experience in the natural world. So that's naturalism, but anti-a priorism. And going beyond those experiences in an essential way, so that is theory formation. And it's logic, it's locally semantic, so we are thinking in terms of models satisfying sentences. But globally coherentist, right? But non-conventionalist. So we'll see in a second what I mean by that, but settling on axioms that force themselves to be true, as Gödel said, by intrinsic as well as extrinsic. Russell calls this regressive thinking or argument. I will come back to that too. And a continuous sharpening of concepts that are not generally vague, but they can be sort of made more precise. So no realism in ontology, but realism in truth value. And there is a similar view in Pfefferman's later thinking, you know, what he calls conceptual structuralism. I don't want to read everything here, but he talks about a social matrix that has given rise, among other things, to social institution and games. And this is exactly what I don't think is the right analogy, you know, because institutions are governed by conventions and games, of course, also. But what is, and then what makes mathematics unique, though, is the endless fecundity. We had that before. He does acknowledge that, of course, you see. But I wouldn't, you know, there are papers, even books written about this sort of analogy between institutions and mathematical practice. I don't think that's the right track. Now, let me get into set theory. And so here we have this rough notion of the universe of sets. And what do we want to do with it? Well, capture the nature of infinity. So for instance, we have, you know, the well-known properties, inexhaustibility that leads to reflection principles, the iterative conception of set leads to the cumulative hierarchy, closure conditions, that's the kind of algebraic concern. And you know, we started with one infinite object, omega, you know, and talking about the properties of omega and want to generalize them. That's a natural move. So what kind of generalization are possible? Closure under the operations. So omega is closed and strong inaccessibles, that's the next stage where you get closure. And omega has the tree property, that's Koenig's lemma. And if you generalize that, you get weakly compact cardinals, and compactness can, of course, be defined in terms of infinitary languages. And then you could also, if you lift the restriction, get to a strong compactness. And then, for instance, partitions. You have the pigeonhole principle. It's very intuitive. And I use this arrow notation here. So you have finite Ramsey. You have infinite Ramsey. Can be proved instead of C. And now if you change omega to some bigger kappa, right, then you end up again at weakly compact cardinals. Or even if you sort of generalized the subsets of kappa that can be divided onto these various partitioned into these various slots, then you get a Ramsey cardinal. So, and then of course, that was mentioned before, you have this notion small versus large, right? Infinite sets in omega are large. And if omega could be measurable, if the definition would allow it, but typically one starts with cardinalities bigger than omega, and then we are at measurable cardinals, and of course these are ultra filters, and they give rise to elementary embeddings, and here is a kind of change in methodology. Now elementary embeddings is basically doing the job for these various increasingly strong conditions in the, you want to come closer to V, and so like here's a list of typical large cardinals, among them wooden cardinals, like this one here, and so on. Okay, but as I say, lost in independence. And that's the problem. So let's start with analysis. this innocuous idea of a Suslin line. You know, it's basically the real line. You take away separability, but keep the countable chain condition. And then, you know, do they exist? It's independent. Kaplansky's conjecture, that's about Banach algebras. You know, you try to prove something and you're stuck, right? And then, of course, the descriptive set theory, you know, analytic sets of reals are the Beck measurable, but if you increase the complexity, they get independent. You know, this is my little private sign for is independent of. Borel determinacy is provable, but projective determinacy is not. And then, of course, CH. Sometimes in philosophical discussion, it's, you know, you get the impression it's always about the continuum, you know. But there is a large range of independent propositions. Now, yes? Oh, it should be set of C, of course. Yeah. All right. So here we go. This is Cohen in the year 1990. He actually had, in a sense, lost contact with the set theoretic community, right? So in an interview, he says the following: certainly, Gödel himself had the Platonic view that the question demanded an absolute answer. My personal view is that I regard the present solution of the problem as very satisfactory. I think it is the only possible solution. There will be philosophical papers, right? But I don't think any mathematical paper will say that there is any answer other than the answer that it is undecidable. Okay? All right. Now, the conoscenti, what's that? Who knows? Who recognizes that? Notebook. Pardon?
Hugh Williams' notebook.
It's Hugh Wooden's ontology, right. So here are all these, you know, moving cardinals, right? Okay, I'm going to talk about Hugh Wooden now. He started off, as I said, as an analyst. You know, see Kaplansky's conjecture on Banach algebras. Frustrated by independence results in set theory at almost every turn, he set out to track set theoretic truth by sharpening, as he says, our conception of the universe of sets. Now, the embarrassing thing is he had a first phase where CH is false, and the second phase now, where he thinks it's true, right? But this really is a sign of a regular philosopher. You know, take Wittgenstein, he had two philosophies, and Husserl, and Heidegger. How does this come about? I will skip this result about Kaplansky's conjecture. In the 80s, you know, of course, was done this amazing work in this group of people listed here, and more and others, of course, and about the connection between large cardinal axioms and descriptive set theory. One major result is the existence of infinitely many Wooden cardinals implied projective determinacy. And Wooden says in 1994 the following: the theory that follows from the assumption of projective determinacy is so rich that, a posteriori, the axiom is both consistent and true. The lesson here is an important one. Axioms need not be a priori true. And that harks back to what Russell said about the regressive method. He wrote it. It's a paper in 1905. So the first assault on CH is false. And here in 1994, he says, recent results show for the first time a canonical model. Now, for the expert, what is canonical here, right? it's basically, you know, highly absolute structure, and the line of research, you know, led to this volume of 900 pages or so of Wooden, where he basically comes up with an interpolant between Aleph 0 and 2 to the Aleph 0, right? So continuum is Aleph 2. So it's not anything, just like in Cohen forcing, you can have Aleph 17 or so. It's Aleph 2. And in 2001, there was this conference in Munich, 100 years of Russell's paradox, and Wooden delivered a nice paper. He called it Set Theory After Russell, The Journey Back to Eden, right? Continuum hypothesis is still false, but he makes a philosophical statement. He says, do I believe the axiom of projective determinacy is true? This I find to be a rather frequently asked question of me. My answer is this. I believe the axiom of projective determinacy is as true as the axioms of number theory. So I suppose I advocate a position that might best be described as conditional Platonism. Right? Now, in 2006, there was the Gödel centenary in Vienna, and Wooden gave a key address there. And he mentions the equiconsistency of three theories. He came up with, you know, the main thing is you have the large cardinals and you have the determinacy and some infinite combinatorial statement in low in the hierarchy, and he connected them as equiconsistent. And then he came up with what I call Wooden's wager. It's just like Pascal's wager, right? In the next 10,000 years, there will be no discovery of an inconsistency in these theories. This is a specific and unambiguous prediction about the physical universe, which is based on the development of set theory in the last 50 years, and on my belief that the conception of the transfinite universe of sets is meaningful. So he doesn't take that for granted. He says, okay, we have all these beautiful results, and that makes it meaningful, right? So now, and then after, perhaps one you can tell, when did he really come up with V equals L, ultimate L? Do you know? When did he come up with V equals ultimate L? Do you know?
Well, it depends what you mean by that.
The idea, you know, this kind of change of methodology.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So what I write here is, you know, the 80s had also revealed that if you have infinitely many Wooden cardinals, then CH for projective sets holds. So he changes the strategy, and, you know, in view of the fact that the projective sets are definable over V omega plus 1. So he wants to take up definability as high as possible and use a constructive universe L as a template to get an idea what a axiom could be like. So V equals L, of course, doesn't work because, you know, it settles CH. But there are no large cardinals, Scott's theorem. So, and Wooden says simply, that's false, right? Penny Maddy makes a long argument why you should, you know, reject V equals L. But for Wooden, that's already doing it. Okay, now, here, of course, Conoscenti, the experts have to correct me if I'm saying something wrong. He comes up with this notion of universally bare sets. This is interesting because it's almost a topological notion. You know, it really comes from the bare sets, the generalization of the bare sets. And so they are called called universal, because if you have a topological space X and a continuous function to the reals or R to the N, then something is universally bare, a subset, if the pre-image has a property of bare, right? That sounds pretty simple, but of course it has ramifications in the theory, in set theory, in terms of trees. So global definability is expressed by HOD, H-O-D, the hereditarily ordinal definable sets. And HOD here is computed in L of A and R. You close the constructible universe with a universally bare set and the reals. And then you get these models of the form HOD, super L of AR. That sentence is true in V, I suppose, to reflect to. So in extrapolating from this characterization V equals L without specifying the definition, he arrives at the following, because people talked about this axiom. Here it is. So of course you have to assume a proper class of wooden cardinals, right? And that's important. That's why you think he thinks you really need that. And then we talked about sigma, two sentences. If phi holds in V, that's of course important, then there is a universally bare set A such that HOD super L of AR satisfies phi. And so this is the reflection thing, right? And this is written down in this long bulletin of symbolic logic paper in 2017. And Wooden seems to be telling basically the same thing still today. But you have to correct me if that's wrong. And then there are these consequences. The continuum hypothesis holds and V equals HOD. And since I'm running out of time, I will not, you know, the important thing is for this to work, you know, he has to make sure that there is no further Scott's theorem, right? And let me just, and Wooden's claim here is adopting the axiom completely negates the ramifications of Cohen's method. It sounds like he doesn't like forcing. But, you know, you cannot really be accused of that, you know. He's one of the champions of forcing. It's more a philosophical point, right? And so how can we do that? You know, there is this, Joel Hamkins actually had some criteria to make sure that one can prove a universality theorem. And so they can set up a conjecture, and this is technical. I won't even start to explain this if you start out with an extendable, but important, then provably, there's a transitive class N, such N is a weak extender model for delta supercompact, and satisfies V equals ultimate L, and then he has two futures, either. First of all, what's important for him, this statement here is a, as he said, a number theoretic statement, you know, if it's arithmetized. And so he says it's either true or false, but you cannot argue, unlike CH, you cannot argue that it's meaningless. Strange comment here. Okay, according to Wooden, either this works, it's not proven yet, or it doesn't work. Then we are back to square one, and he says we have to find completely different methods in order to proceed. And let me quickly go through two final slides here, assessing Wooden's philosophy. I view Wooden's effort as an attempt to realize Gödel's dream, you know, of understanding the infinite in rigorous mathematical terms. And the goal is to sharpen our conception of universe of sets. You know, that can be seen as operationalizing Gödel's conceptual realism. And you say V equals ultimate L entails V equals hard. Does that mean, after all, that V doesn't contain all sets? So he believes that the conception of a transfinite universe is meaningful, and rightly so. But interestingly, it's not that the decision here of this proposition gives it meaning in the first place. You know, you can have an issue or a question that has meaning even before it's answered, right? So, and he seems to move from a conditional Platonism, I gave you the quote, to predictions about set theory as claims about the physical world. This looks to me like a strange shift in subject matter from mathematics to what mathematicians will be able to prove, thereby, to me, dodging the realism issue. Now, what's the philosophical takeaway? Theoretical naturalism provides a conceptual setting in which mathematical truth in general and set theoretic truth in particular can find a place. Anti-Platonist, revisionist truth theories have no clue why classical mathematics, including set theory, works. You know, that's a plain fact. Wooden's methodology is compatible with my theoretical naturalism as I conceive it. And in line with this theoretical naturalism, now transcendentalism, a la Gödel and Husserl, is called for. What I mean here is, you know, Gödel says there is this concept of set out there, you know. You only have to discover it. But, and Husserl had the same kind of move. That's why Gödel liked Husserl and read a lot of his work. This entails that there is no a priori guarantee that the collective endeavor of the mathematical community will settle on a unique kind of set theoretic truth. Truth should be understood more like a Kantian regulative idea. But that does not mean that pluralism or relativism should it be admitted to reign. So I'm not taken in by Hamkin's multiverse philosophy. Of course, he is a distinguished set theorist, but the kind of philosophical conclusions he draws are not convincing to me. All right, thank you.